commentary. Heard each morning before the 7:30 news on AM 550, FM 99.9, WSAU. Here's Chris Conley.
I can't help but think of the Maya Angelou book, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, while I was reading Tinashe Coates' essay in The Atlantic, The Case for Reparations. I have a link to that article in our news blog section at WSAU.com. You've probably heard that Maya Angelou died this week at her home in North Carolina at age 86. The reparations article that was published a week ago has generated a lot of discussion. In the Maya Angelou book, many white readers were introduced to the Jim Crow South for the first time. While white America was entering the era of the Great Society, even affluent blacks in the South feared lynchings, the Klan, and race riots. Maya is the name of the semi-autobiographical character in the book. She can't get her tooth filled by a white dentist, even though her black grandmother gave that doctor money during the Depression. There are moments of race solidarity, like when Joe Louis wins the heavyweight boxing title. But the constant weight of oppression is the norm in Sparks, Arkansas. And many modern-day blacks still know this feeling, real or perceived, while whites do not. The first time I read I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, I was taken aback at how cruel the black characters in the book are towards each other. Maya suffers a brutal rape at a young age by a man her mother trusted. Maya's parents abandon her and her brother to relatives they barely knew. Her father retrieves her years later and takes her from that stable life to move her to an urban ghetto in St. Louis. He mistreats his children when he's drunk, and he allows his girlfriend to throw his daughter into the streets. Maya finds healing and her voice through a chance encounter. The lesson is unmistakable. Most others will not be so lucky, and their lives will turn out differently. Now, the article, The Case for Reparations, is very well researched, and it is thought-provoking, but it is still unconvincing in its final argument. It tells about the contract loan mortgage schemes of the 1920s that extended into the post-World War II era. Redlining, restrictive zoning, neighborhood associations, they were used by banks, landlords, and neighbors to deny blacks the opportunities of home ownership. The claim is that white families were building wealth through the properties they bought, and blacks were being fleeced. Now, the government has been complacent with housing policies that favored white families and were blind to abuses. Government racism may be the strongest case for reparations, and Tinashe Coates' article makes a convincing case about the GI Bill, Social Security, and Medicare, all of which were tilted towards whites over blacks. But the case for reparations falls apart in two areas. First, in a very long article, there's no discussion about personal responsibility. While some of America's race gap is undoubtedly the result of real racism in our country's past, some of it is also the result of self-destructive individual choices. Vice and nonconformity, while not universal, is highly prevalent and have a tremendous impact on different life outcomes. Second, reparations still has the problem of being extra-legal. If you were wronged by someone, you'd take them to court. But the actual proving of damages from slave labor that ended generations ago is impossible, and assessing those damages to the U.S. taxpayer is twisted. Should my family, we're immigrants from Ireland and Italy and faced our own discrimination when we got here, should we have to pay reparations to a family from Nigeria that may have moved here 100 years after slavery ended to build a better life in our country than they would have had back home? Ultimately, the Tinashe Coates article poisons the well that he's trying to draw water from. He suggests that one reason America won't discuss reparations is that the amount claimed may be more than we're able to pay. That argument says that all of our nation's wealth is built on enslaved Negroes picking cotton in the South. It feathered the beds of the railroad barons, profited the bankers and financiers, and was backed by our insurance and manufacturing industries. The argument says it created a stream of wealth that flowed to white Northern Americans and then across the Atlantic to our benefactors in Europe. It's a narrative that's not true. American ingenuity and economic advancement was also fueled by millions who came here post-slavery. Marconi, Einstein, Jobs, they don't owe a debt to slavery. And to hear an argument that our nation should make reparations that still might not be enough to square our race relations account turns a long-shot argument into an absurdity.